And you, Molly Wood, are an old.
I'm an old.
Oh, God.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, my God. That was a plaintive cry if ever I have heard one from one Ms. Molly Wood.
I'm crossed over.
Hey, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
She's old. Welcome to Make Me Smart, everybody. Our podcast about tech, the economy, culture. We learn a ton because, as we like to say, none of us is as smart as all of us.
Turns out no one was smart enough to keep me from becoming an old.
It just happened.
Anyway.
Man. Are you wearing reading glasses, by the way?
I am.
Oh, are you? I'm really sorry. I didn't know.
You monster.
Go ahead. All right.
I'm in a weakened condition.
Oh, my God.
My son informed me that I say LOL wrong and I'm old. And then Megan McCarty Carino, who is otherwise very lovely and who we're going to talk to in a minute, confirmed that this is apparently correct.
You aren't old.
So I'm just giving up on life right now.
Anyway, should we get to why Megan McCarty Carino is in the studio here with me in Los Angeles? Let's
so,
do that.
So Megan, you guys are hanging out, is in the studio because today we are going to talk about this thing that we talk around and about and through all the time, which is the future of work, specifically the gig economy and how the law is attempting to catch up to it.
The law, actually, here in California, being this new thing that just got signed like the other day, right?
Like last week.
AB 5 is what it's called, Assembly Bill 5, which, among many other things, goes to Uber and Lyft drivers and other contract workers in this economy and obliges, to some degree, companies to change their status from contractors to actual employees with all that entails, giving them protection.
Right. And it's all part and parcel of this sort of larger conversation, which is what is work supposed to look like and how do workers get protections when increasingly lots of them are either choosing or being forced to take these kind of independent contractor gigs. Who that applies to, because we tend to only think of it in terms of these rideshare companies, who, by the way, Uber is actually just trying to say, good luck with that new law. We're not going to do it. Mm. We're not going to reclassify our workers because our core business is not providing rides, which maybe we'll talk about in a minute. But it also, you know, plenty of critics are arguing that this misses the mark, AB 5.
With all of that as prologue, Megan McCarty Carino was here. She's our workplace culture correspondent at Marketplace, does this kind of stuff for us. And we've been looking for a way for like months to have her on because she's awesome. And here she is. So first of all, thanks for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And let us start with how define as broadly as you can gig economy.
Oh,
workers,
man.
Right?
Man.
Yeah.
Define.
Take all the time you need.
Gig economy. I think this.
We love a definition.
This is where it is so hard to kind of sort through all of these issues because I think there's such a broad spectrum of things that we think of as the gig economy these days when we talk about gig work. Sometimes we're talking about independent contractors. I think kind of the classic, you know, gig work we think of where the term probably, you know, originates is music gigs, gigs that people were doing, artists or, you know, things that are kind of one-off things that they do. You go play at a club, you go, do your art somewhere, whatever. It's just, it's a one-time thing. It's a gig. You're not an employee. You're not going clocking in somewhere. Of course, it's come to be known and associated most strongly with people like Uber drivers, Lyft drivers, TaskRabbit, DoorDash, all of these kinds of task-based work that people are doing kind of through these tech platforms that have risen up, Uber being the foremost among them, where they are classified up until, kind of tentative right now, but have been classified as independent contractors, where they do some work. Some people do it on the side. Some people do these jobs full time. Yeah. We have people driving for Uber full time. We have people who are doing also just jobs that have been contract work for a long time.
Right.
You know, the trucking industry. Yeah. There are happy contractors.
Right, well, right, yeah.
There are happy contractors, but it also, you know, we should say that at this moment, today, Google contractors in Pittsburgh are voting on whether or not to unionize. And so it seems like, in a way, Uber and Lyft building this business model that depends on these part-time workers or full-time contractors, shone this light, right, on how prevalent the use of contractors are, even in public radio and beyond.
Absolutely, yeah.
Or where they're
so,
called,
like, let's talk about sort of that part of it, which is, like, how did this intersect with the freelance economy and get people all fired up there.
I think how prevalent it is still kind of a big question, honestly. You know, it's very, very visible these days with all of these gig economy companies right. kind of in our face and making news all the time. But there is some debate about exactly how prevalent it is. I mean, we have reported mm-hmm. on the show, you know, that still the vast majority of workers in our economy are full-time employees. And, you know, the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics, they have kind of, their estimate is on the conservative side. They say, you know, 10% maybe at this point, contractor or alternative. Mm. Other estimates, you know, the marketplace, we had an Edison poll last year all about the gig economy, right. and 24% said that they had done some kind of gig work.
Right. So let's put some numbers to that, right? 10% yeah. of the American workforce is about 16 million people. 25% is, you know, plus or minus 35-ish million people. So it's yeah. not a huge slice of the right. economy, but it's a lot of people.
Yeah. And people think, mm-hmm. you know, with all of these kinds of visible things happening, say, you know, Lowe's turning thousands of their workers mm-hmm. into gig workers, with, you know, we see this happening, businesses kind of paring down, trying to increase their margins by outsourcing some jobs into gig work. And so it looms large yeah. in the consciousness yeah, as a sure. direction that we're going.
Because we all love Ubers.
And
right?
so then,
you know, right?
I love Lyft.
Okay, Lyft. But, yeah. I'll take your pick. You know what I mean, right?
Actually, I hate yeah. them all. True yeah. story. I prefer to drive my own car whenever possible. Mm-hmm. However, let's talk about then this idea of protection, because the numbers are increasing, right? Even though it's relatively small now or still hard to measure,
yeah.
44% of those gig workers, according to our Edison poll, yeah. say that work in the gig economy is their primary source
yeah.
of income. And I think there is this sense that work could change
yeah.
and that might be great. But it's not great if you don't have any protections and if companies are really just doing it so they can save a bunch of money. So let's talk about this sort of like move toward protection, where AB5 right. is kind of all the way to what
to
some would argue is an old
spectrum.
Model. Right.
Yeah.
The other
yeah.
end of the spectrum. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think there is this kind of anxiety that workers are increasingly being left without really important benefits, you know, health care, workers' compensation. You hear about drivers who get into a crash when maybe they weren't in the middle of a drive or something. And, you know, they're left with these huge medical bills and these huge bills for their car crash. And, you know, that an increasing number of workers are not getting the kind of base level of protections mm-hmm. that, you know, help our economy kind of function smoothly, I mean, in basic ways and help workers live a lifestyle that is, you know, of the quality right, that right. we want in America. And so I think there's just so much anxiety that so many workers seem to be, even ones who may be fully employed, not quite making it mm-hmm. in our economy, not able to, you know, provide basic things for their family or afford extremely high rents or mortgages in our, you know, really expensive cities. And so I think that there's a sense that, yeah, we do need to do more to ensure that there are these basic protections for all workers. And that is kind mm-hmm. of where AB5 right. flows from.
So the economy doesn't work, as we've talked about many times on this podcast. The economy doesn't work for many, many people in this economy, right? And the gig economy is a manifestation of that.
Right.
The flip side, of course, is that Uber's business model doesn't work without their ability to get this kind of labor yeah. for cheap, cheap, cheap.
Yeah.
Right?
Either way, it
yeah.
doesn't work.
Right. Right. And yeah. thus, we are on the horns of a dilemma.
Well, and
or are we
to
not?
To be fair, well, I don't know. I mean, I guess that's, you know, Megan, you and I had this conversation on the tech show, which is like, is there a third way? Because
yeah.
so AB5 comes in and says employees or
yeah.
nothing.
Yeah.
And then all of these therapists and
right.
musicians.
Translators. And
translators,
yeah.
right, who are independent contractors say, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah. Nurse
right.
anesthesiologist.
Work.
Yeah.
Wow. Huh.
And this is going to be a problem. So, like, what is a middle right. ground that sort of allows people to have it both ways?
Well, I think that
it's hopeful.
One of the, you know, kind of main issues that this whole debate kind of fleshes out is just how we have set up so many of our, you know, our safety net and so many benefits in our society are based on this traditional full-time employment mm-hmm. model. Mm-hmm. So you get your health care from your full-time employer, you get retirement through your full-time employer, you get, you know, protections if you are injured on the job or unemployment. All these things have flowed through traditional full-time employment. And even for people who are happily working as contractors, these are challenges that, you know, are unmet in many cases. So, you know, the old model of I'm going to get a job at the ground floor of this corporation in mid-century America and stay there and kind of work my way up and get all these benefits from the company and train and do different jobs and stay there for a really long time. That is not a reality for good reasons and for bad reasons. You know, of course, companies have changed the way that, you know, they're trying to increase their margins, but also, you know, our society has changed. We want more flexibility around different things. You know, one of the reasons that a lot of people do gig work is for the flexibility. And people are not staying in the same job. They're not staying in the same profession for, you know, for as many years as they were before. So I think it kind of, it brings up big questions about, is this really the best way for us to administer these things that we decided long ago, you know, okay, these are important things for workers to have, and they'll go through the employer because that was the traditional way that people functioned in their work lives.
I should know this, but I don't. So California has AB 5. Are other states going to follow the lead? Do other states have their own going on? And is there any movement at the federal level on these kinds of protections? Do you know?
So I know that there are, you know, states that are watching California and have kind of dipped their toe in the water in terms of using this criteria that California is using to define what a contract worker or an employee is. So this is what the law in California, it doesn't actually say, okay, these gig workers are employees. It says, it codifies in law, this is the criteria we're going to use in the courts. And so a lot of, AB 5 has already been cited in a lot of court cases in other states already saying, you know, this is the criteria that California uses. This is what this court should use to determine these court cases over who is a contractor. In terms of the federal level, of course, right now, you know, politics plays a lot into how things are being interpreted at the federal level. The National Labor Relations Board has had some memos and some decisions that basically kind of cut out gig workers from any consideration as an employee. In terms of trying to kind of break out of this stark bifurcation between contractor and employee, I haven't seen much action. There is an idea in California that maybe these workers could join unions that would not be company-based unions like we have in the rest of America, but kind of industry-based unions.
I mean, there's
unions.
Stuff like the Writers Guild, right?
Yeah,
stuff like that, which provides insurance coverage and you know, some other
and even
of
like taxi drivers are independent contractors, and they are able to join unions. So if they were able to kind of join unions but remain independent contractors, maybe fight for some of the benefits that are important to them, but not have the full, like, onerous, you know, weight of all of the various things that apply to employees that might not make a lot of sense for the way that the gig economy has operated so far.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting in a way, I think, that AB 5 is so stark.
Yeah.
That it is so bifurcated in a state where so much work is moving this way. And it does make you wonder, like, are people romanticizing the freedom, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's...
health insurance is on the line.
yeah. I mean, all of the surveys that I have seen, federal surveys, you know, surveys by freelancer groups, everything that I have seen that has tried to take an account of how many people in our economy are working as independent contractors has found that a vast majority are happy to be working that way with that untraditional working arrangement. And so I don't think it's necessary like that. Of course, I'm sure if these people are working without any benefits and without any safety net, that they're not happy about that part of it.
Right.
But in terms of the actual arrangement of kind of being your own boss, the people who are doing it, for the most part, that is a big benefit to them, and they are happy about that.
Not to get all processy and dismal here, but this is going to wind up in the courts, and I'm going to guess we are years away from any kind of resolution on what the what, right?
Yeah, most likely. So it's going to get, I mean, Uber's decision to basically defy this rule and say, okay, we're not going to automatically reclassify basically means, they're waiting for it to kind of wind its way through the courts. And also, you know, they have said, along with Lyft and DoorDash, that they're going to fund some kind of referendum that'll go before California voters to reverse the law.
Because direct democracy.
Yes.
That's always better.
that always, you know, adds some time to things that... It, in without these things going on, it would go into effect in January 2020. You know, estimates are probably it wouldn't come anywhere close to going into effect until at least, you know, 2021, if then. So we're definitely years off from this being resolved, and a lot can happen in that time. A lot of kind of negotiation can happen in that time.
Megan McCarty-Carino is the Workplace Culture Desk here at Marketplace, making us smart on this gig economy thing, which, as she said, is going to go on for years and years and years. Thanks for coming in. Really
Thanks,
appreciate
you.
It.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Megan.
So let us know what you think about
the
gig economy.
I like how you just make it
what?
Like the bummer.
What? Well, look, man, that's
which
my...
Which is going to go
I
on for
I know the
years
job that I play on this podcast. It is my thing. Come on. Let us know what you think. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Send us a voice memo. If you're a gig economy worker and you like it, tell us. And if you hate it, tell us. And why? Send us a voice memo. We'll be back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
Boom, there we go. All right. You're going to go first? I see two there. Cheater.
I do. I'm throwing in Greta Thunberg, too. Like, I'm just, like, not. I'm taking over.
Yeah, how about
I'm
Greta
taking
Thunberg?
Over the news fix. I've had it with this one. You know what? I don't know who made this rule that it can only be one, but I don't think it was
did.
Me.
I think we made the rule that it can only be one.
I feel like I'd remember that. I don't know. I was just struck. Okay, well, I'm going to back up and say that number two on my list is really just a shorty. It's okay. Just a little banana pants update, which I feel contractually obliged to do at this point. I wish we had a banana pants sting.
I know, right?
And it could be like Arrested Development. There's always money in the banana stand.
Always money in the banana stand. That's right.
In banana pants news today, I feel obliged to share that WeWork CEO Adam Neumann is stepping down as CEO of the company. He will become a non-executive chairman of the We company.
It's a big, big deal.
It is a big deal. And then in other stories related yes. to companies that have founders with lots and lots of control who would like to control even more, Facebook just bought a startup yeah. for between $500 million and $1 billion
oh,
that will allow you to control computers with your mind. It's called Control Labs.
What could possibly go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong? It just... I mean, so many things are fascinating. One, the technology is fascinating, and it's not dramatically new, but it sounds like this startup has raised a ton of money in venture capital and uses this bracelet to measure neuron activity in your arm.
Oh, my God.
To determine what you're thinking about, even if you're not actually moving, and then that creates a movement on a digital screen.
Okay.
Yeah. So the way that, and then the way that Facebook's head of augmented and virtual reality kind of just like melting down. This is why I wanted to bring this up.
I can't even. Come on.
It's its own kind
Here,
of banana
put
pants.
Put this bracelet on.
Put this
and
bracelet
step
on.
Step into my matrix.
and control the portal. Exactly. But you have put your finger on exactly what is happening here. Like, while we're still futzing around talking about how should we, you know, regulate the chat versus this thing and the social media, they are playing 15 years in the future to when we all live in their Ready Player One world.
Right. And meanwhile, you've got Orrin Hatch, recently retired from the United States Senate, saying, Mr. Zuckerberg, how does your company make money? I mean, come on, you guys. Jesus.
I know we like fundamentally disagree on that, though, because I saw a Pew survey the other day that said that still something like 74% of Americans were surprised to discover that Facebook collects information about your interests and uses them to serve you ads.
Yes, but Orrin Hatch, while old, was an elected representative of the people of the United States trying to regulate a company which has profound influence on the society and the global economy, and he doesn't know up from down. I know he's retired. I know I'm speaking ill of a very nice old man, and oh my goodness, but come on, it's like symptomatic.
I think we should call him. Now that he's retired, I think we should call him, because I still maintain that I don't think he didn't know. I think he wanted Mark Zuckerberg on the record, not being like, we're building communities, we're connecting people.
I think you are high if you believe that.
That he was like, we sell ads, that's our business.
Yeah, there's no way Orrin Hatch knew what he was talking about.
I don't know.
Zero chance.
Let's call him.
All right, what else
you
got? You said you had three?
Facebook is playing far in the future.
Yeah.
Far in the future. You know, I just wanted to say that I have been doing all this coverage on the climate stuff, and obviously I'm a little steeped in it. But when I heard Greta Thunberg's speech at the UN Climate Action Summit yesterday, I burst into tears.
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words, and yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering, people are dying, entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
And I know that I'm a little bit of a jello lady. I'm a crier. I'm a softy. But to hear her at 16 years old be brave enough to basically say, you know, if you don't do something now, you have stolen my future, broke my heart. It made me cry. And then to see the equal and opposite reaction to that just makes me a little despairing. This is why I had to ask a friend for a kitten picture today. A little bit despairing that we will actually do or accomplish anything on this issue if we can't even agree to, like, leave a kid alone.
Go check out that video. It's really kind of incredible.
She's remarkable.
Yeah.
She's
kind of amazing. So, my turn?
Yep.
Different,
your turn.
Different thing.
You can have a few if you want.
Less gloomy.
You got like
I only got one. I just want to, for those who might not be following the business and economic news perhaps as closely as I am, you may perhaps have heard in the last 10 days or so of this thing going on in what's called the repo market. And I want to do two things. I want to explain very briefly what the repo market is, and then I want to tell
God,
you why
do.
It's a thing you should know about but not worry about. So the repo market is this. Every night, literally every night, the big banks and the big shadow banking institutions and hedge funds and what have you basically balance out their books. And the way they do this is by swapping money or securities, right? They say, I need $300 million here. I've got some treasury bonds here. You can have them, blah, blah, blah. To balance their books, they move money around literally overnight. On the order of trillions of dollars. And it usually happens fairly fluidly, no big deal, everything's fine, it's just the way things work, okay? Beginning of last week, for a lot of reasons that I don't want to get into, they ran out of cash. They had to pay tax bills, they had other things going on, and those big institutions ran out of cash. And so what happens when cash gets scarce is that the cost of money goes up, right? It's this thing called supply and demand. And when the cost of money goes up, that's another way to say interest rates. So the interest rates in the overnight repo market went really, really high. And instead of being down around 2% where the Fed wants it, it got up to 10%, which is a lot when you're trading trillions of dollars. So the Federal Reserve jumped in, plowed tens of billions of dollars, and is still plowing tens of billions of dollars into this overnight repo market. So that's what's been going on. The Fed is providing liquidity so that these banks can, in essence, balance their books because they ran out of cash. Okay? That's what's happening.
Okay.
It is tempting to believe, since the last time there was a problem in the repo market, there was this thing called Lehman Brothers going on, right? And the great financial crisis and the recession. It is tempting to believe that this is a precursor to that again. It is not. What was happening back then was a credit crisis. People did not believe they were going to be paid back. So nobody wanted to lend, say, Lehman Brothers $100 million because they were afraid they weren't going to get it back. That was a credit crisis. This is a much easier problem. It's a liquidity crisis. It's a cash crisis. And the Federal Reserve is here to say, here is $100 million or here is $3 billion or whatever. And the Fed is providing liquidity. So while this is not normal, while it is a little bit of a problem and we should keep an eye on it, it is not, repeat, not Lehman Brothers. That's all I wanted to say.
All right. I appreciate you saying that. But so we shouldn't worry about any of the reasons that they ran out of cash?
No.
All right.
Truly, what
I
you
mean,
could be,
I would love be, it if somebody would come in when I have liquidity problems. And be like,
I know.
Dollars,
I know. Well, look, if you become a systemically important financial institution, Molly Wood, we will certainly arrange that for you.
I'm working on it. Also, okay. I would like that on a T-shirt. Molly Wood, colon, systemically important financial institution unto herself.
Yes. All right. So that's my spiel. That's what I got. So keep an
Thank
eye on
you.
It. Read about it. Now you know about it, but don't, you know, lose sleep over it.
I would like to know you to know that I sat on my chaise lounge with surrounded by tissues and Cipacol this weekend with coffee, and I read the Wall Street Journal story in the actual newspaper about the repo market like 35 times and could not understand what it said. So thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
I appreciate
Glad I could
it.
Help. Now
it is our fall fundraiser, and someone at Marketplace has had some really good ideas. But before we get to that, we know you hear this pitch a lot. But we actually really mean that we can all get smarter together and not without your support. It is fundraising time. Become a Marketplace investor today because we have the cleverest name in the fundraising game. Marketplace.org/donate is where you can invest.
You can become a Marketplace investor. And here's the deal. If we raise $50,000 by Thursday, September 26th, right? So that's 2 days from when we're speaking right now. We get another 50 large from our friends at the Candida Fund. Right? And your dollar then goes twice as far. But we got to get to 50 first from you guys. Okay? And we are oh so very close.
It is my understanding that we are oh so very close. Like as of this moment or as of tape time, we were $5,000 away. That's like nothing. Come on.
Oh, yeah.
And here's the thing. Candida Fund, yay. But I know the deep sighs have already started. I would like to know who came up with this idea. It is genius. If we hit the $50,000 goal, Kai will drink a pumpkin spice latte.
If you know anything about me, that was very good. That was very good.
That was really, really good.
If you know anything about me, if you follow me on Twitter, if you have heard me on Marketplace, you know that I loathe pumpkin spice to the depths of my soul. I think it's just an abomination. So every year when pumpkin spice latte rolls out or pumpkin spice Cheetos or pumpkin spice Frito-Lays or pumpkin spice car oil or take your pick, it's my own little seventh circle of hell. So what happened was the very creative people at whatever department we have here at Marketplace that thinks up diabolical schemes said, hey, what if we go to Kai and say, look, for 50 grand, which we could double to $100,000, would you drink a pumpkin spice latte? And me being a team player said, sure, not really thinking that we would ever get there because, come on, that's a lot of money. I know, but come on, 50 grand is a lot of money.
You mercenary. Little do you know, you have yourself created the exact conditions for this kind of thing to exist. Because, Kai, how have you not learned after low these many years? You never actually tell people what you don't like and don't like.
I know.
I mean, come on. The pumpkin spice thing is magical. Yes. Magical.
I need to say this. It's $50,000, people. It's not $49,999.99. It's 50 grand. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that's the number we got to hit. Here's what I'm thinking. We all know I like beer, right? I like really good crafted IPAs. Here's what I'm thinking. Here's what I'm thinking for the next drive. For
I feel a sense of wiggle.
For $100,000, I will drink a pumpkin spice beer.
Ooh.
And that would just,
because that's even more
of an
abomination.
What do I even do with myself?
That would crush me.
What do I do with myself? That's all I'm saying.
That would crush him.
Marketplace.org/donate.
If you too would like to crush Kai, Chase.org/donate.
All right. We milked that one far enough. Let us move on.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right. So what we did this week with Megan McCarty-Carino and the whole gig economy thing kind of builds on a show that we did April last, number 109 in your program guide, we're told by Tony Wagner, producer, about the workforce of the future and what it's going to look like and all of that stuff. And so we're going to riff on that for a little while in your comments.
We are. We talked about anchor jobs, the like stable thing that makes you money, but maybe not quite enough money. And then side hustles, the other stuff that you do, maybe because you hope it'll be your career, or more likely because this is America in 2019, you need a little more income to pay that dang rent.
Erica Kane emailed us to talk about that distinction. She said she hates the term side hustle because, and this is the quote, the popularization of the side hustle has grown to include the evening and or weekend jobs we increasingly need to pay the bills and keep body and soul together. I worry, she says, that normalizing and glamorizing the side hustle also normalizes this need and the unlivable wages that come with, quote, day jobs, which
is true, right?
Yeah, it's totally true.
I totally agree. Totally I remember when those Uber commercials, ironically, started showing up that were like, upgrade your side hustle. And I remember thinking like, that is so mercenary and sad. And then here's the other thing, going back to why I hate rideshare.
Yeah.
I do not want to be, I think that one thing that happens with the gig economy is that then these risk becoming jobs that people don't take very seriously.
Yeah.
I don't want these to be side hustles. I want them to be jobs that that provide the intrinsic and extrinsic motivation to do a good job.
Yep. Yep. Totally.
Last week, we heard a little of the reporting that I've been doing on Marketplace Tech about the technology we need to adapt to climate change, the role that Silicon Valley plays in creating it. And we had a couple people, several people write in to call us out for not mentioning nuclear power. So here is one of them, Peter Weitzel.
Like a lot of green energy coverage, last week's piece in Silicon Valley made no mention of nuclear power at all. And that seems to be kind of par for the course. Are venture capitalists really not interested in next-gen nuclear power? And more broadly, why doesn't nuclear get more attention in green energy coverage? What do people think of when they think about green energy? You know, it's not nuclear.
I don't know, but luckily here was Ryan Edmonds to talk about one specific kind of nuclear power and make us more smarter.
In the last episode, you neglected to bring up the thorium molten salt reactor as a carbon-free technology to meet our energy needs. It promises abundant, cheap, clean energy. We already have mountains of thorium as a byproduct of mining rare earth metals. The transmutation of abundant thorium into physical fuel is a magical solution we needed decades ago.
Dude, what? Can you put that on a PowerPoint and call a VC? I don't know anything about this. I am into magical solutions.
Well, but
no, I mean, I don't.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, so look, these are all amazingly complicated topic, first of all. And I will say, as a completely uninformed bystander, and I know the parallels are not exact, but I watched Chernobyl on HBO. That's what people think of when they think of nuclear power. I'm
now
just
we're gonna, I know. Well,
Three
it's
Mile
true.
Island.
I
think, were you there? I was a seventh. I was a sophomore in high school. People. That's what people think of when they think of nuclear power. I'm just telling you.
Yeah, I think that that's probably fundamentally everybody would tell you that although this is a very complex topic and there are probably really good and magical solutions and not that there's that word, the branding word that you have to get over. But I have to say, I almost wonder if this isn't worth an episode because it is really, really interesting and does keep coming up. Apparently, Andrew Yang is a huge proponent of R&D for new kinds of nuclear power, in particular, the thorium molten salt reactors thing that Ryan mentioned. I don't know. I think it's a show.
All right.
I'm into it.
Let's do it as a show.
Nuclear power, let's all get smart together. Nuclear. It's pronounced nuclear. Then we have Simpsons jokes. Like, it has it all. This episode has it all. Cricket.
Anywho.
Cricket.
Moving to the Make Me Smart question, which is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about, we've got Del Adams, who sent in this voice memo.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Del Adams from Dallas, Texas. Your episode on working women made me think about something I thought I knew, but later found out I was wrong about. While I knew being a working mom was going to be hard, I used to think, well, everyone's got a thing pulling on their focus at work. This will just be my thing. My attention is sometimes divided, and I constantly adjust to find the right balance. Recently, I learned from a coworker who was a dad that he understood because his wife constantly felt distracted from her job because she was thinking about their kids. Well, he didn't quite feel the same impact on his focus. But I know many coworkers who play the role of primary working parent, but are not viewed as traditional working moms. I know single fathers, grandparents being parents, and people taking care of their elderly parents. I do want to help support women in all phases of their careers. And I want to extend my empathy to other distracted coworkers by seeking to understand their perhaps less than traditional circumstances that they may find themselves in.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting. Like, we talked about women, but I think there's an argument to that what we were really talking about is parents. Like, there is a whole... That is a nut that we haven't exactly cracked. And we got a lot of feedback about the idea of leave and, you know, should it be longer? Should it be shorter? Does it ultimately punish people? And what we're really saying is, like, how can we support families who also have to work?
Which, in a way, work with me here.
Okay.
Goes back to where we started and the way the labor force in this economy is changing.
Yes. That's, wow. Wow. Oh, well done, buddy.
Boom.
All right. What is your answer to the Make Me Smart question? I love these listener answers. Thank you. Keep sending us the voice memos.
Sure.
MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. You are the oil that keeps this engine going. Wait, no. You're the solar that keeps this grid alive.
Nuclear. No.
Climate week.
You're the wind power.
You're the nuclear power.
Oh, my God. Sorry.
You're the thorium molten salt reactor that keeps this show burning bright.
There are a couple of plugs here. Number one is Make Me Drink a Pumpkin Spice Latte. Please.
Do it.
Number two, newsletters. Here's the plug. Subscribe, marketplace.org/newsletters. There's all kinds of great stuff in there. Erica Phillips writes it. She's amazing. And that's where we are, I think, right? Okay.
Yes,
the music says that's where we are.
You know.
And if the music says it, it must be true.
Make Me Smart was produced and directed this week by Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Eve Tro. We had production oversight from Jody Becker. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Heathcote and Summer Dunsmore.
This week's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez. The theme music, come on, you guys know this by now, Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
You know, I have this really fancy pumpkin spice latte mug. It's bedazzled and bejeweled. Starbucks sent it to me because I tweeted about the PSL
Seriously?
So much in like 2010 or something. What? Yeah.
So it, the PSL was new then. And nobody sends me beer.
And I think I might need to FedEx it to you.
I think you had best not.
For the time when maybe you could put the beer in it. You need this. You need this. This is coming your way. Look out, Rizdal. Check your mail.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.